Hello everyone, it's Anthony DeMarze here and welcome to Lights, Cities and Architecture, a podcast that really talks about sustainability and design. Today I have a really special guest, Mirjana Lovanoska. She's a professor of the School of Architecture at Built Environment at Deakin University. I hope I've got that right, Mirjana.
No.
Would you like to introduce yourself,
Mirjana? No, it's Lovanoska.
Loz.
Everyone says Lov. I mean, that could be love, but Loz.
Lovanoska. A colleague from my university days and a good friend. And she's here as a special guest to talk about her work, especially in the field of migrant architecture here in Australia. Would you like to introduce yourself a little better than I have?
No, it was wonderful, except for the love. Everyone says love because people are thinking of love, I suppose. So, yeah, Professor of Architecture at Deakin University and Director of the Architecture Vacancy Lab, where there's a whole team of people that work on great things related to vacancy.
So I have invited you in because we've had many discussions about migrant architecture here in Australia. And I think talking to you, I hadn't really been aware of the issue, but when we first started this discussion some time ago, it really raised my interest in the whole area. I had never really thought of the idea that migrant architecture was a thing until you raised it, and specifically around housing and the way in which, you know, Southern Europeans, people from different parts of the world, come to Australia and make a contribution to architecture locally. We're taught architecture a little bit differently to that. We tend to be taught a kind of an architecture that relates to modernism, to a sort of more Western idea of what architecture is. And you've sort of introduced this whole different notion to architecture, how architecture is practiced here in Australia. Do you want to just reflect a little bit on your research?
Sure. Well, we're all familiar that we have increasingly culturally diverse cities, but we also perhaps don't remember that before the end of the Second World War, there was not a lot of cultural diversity in Australian, even the major cities like Melbourne and Sydney. They were over 90% homogeneous Anglo-Celtic peoples. So, but you know, the current census says there's about 50% of Australian population is somehow related to coming from overseas. Now, so that already means that if there's these people here, what kind of built environment? So that's, you know, the evolution of the question. But I think for me what happened is that I started looking at houses in the streets where I grew up and thought, oh, no one's ever mentioned these kinds of houses in any of my education. So that's what got me interested. But I have to say there is a sort of a powerful stereotype about migrant houses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mention the word to anyone or the term and they just immediately think of certain things, elements like, you know, concrete and balustrades and things like that. And also there's a sort of even a more powerful myth that our heritage was degraded by post-war immigrants, and particularly in relation to the Victorian era housing that was in the inner city suburbs of many of the cities. So post-war migrants obviously took these little workers' cottages and basically razed all the Victoriana and cleaned that up, cleansed them of Victorian ornamentation, really. Later on, much later on, these things became valuable to our built heritage. But there is something very overlooked in this kind of notched up history, if you like, and that is that when the post-war migrants arrived in places like Melbourne to, mind you, work their guts out, because many of them were labour immigrants and therefore contributed to building our new nation, they could only afford to live where the industrial and manufacturing inner city suburbs of, you know, in Melbourne, Fitzroy, Collingwood, Abbotsford, where we are today, parts of Carlton and so forth. These suburbs were so neglected at that time. The building stock was incredibly degraded. The areas were undesirable to any middle-class Anglo-Celtic peoples. They had all moved to new middle-ring suburbs. So what is completely overlooked is that rather than allowing the inner city suburbs to deteriorate further, this new settlement of immigrant populations reinvigorated these suburbs. They activated sort of modernizing gestures in the built environment, and there was a lot of urban renewal. So this kind of whitewashing that migrants applied to Victorian cottages could actually be perceived as a form of modernization, adding both vibrancy and aesthetic awareness.
So can I talk a little bit about that? Because we look at Victorian architecture quite differently to the time that you're talking about. We're talking about a time when Victorian cottages were not valued. There were slum clearances, lots of destruction of Victorian dwellings of that age, because we were really in a modernist period of architecture, if I'm correct. So your thesis is that in many ways migrants came to these places out of necessity, but provided a sense of renewal to these places, which is something that has been overlooked in more recent times.
Yes, and I suppose because the heritage discourse became quite dominant in the late 70s, but these migrants were here in the 50s and the 60s, and those inner city suburbs were not at that stage, except for some of the professors and students that went to particular universities that were close to the suburbs. They were not the desirable suburbs, so they were degraded. And yes, there were clearances in order to build the high-rise social housing. And we've also got to remember that immigrants did not have access to social housings except for British immigrants. Mm-hmm. So even in places that were regional industrial towns, whether it was Wollongong or even in the Latrobe Valley, so there was very restricted access to housing. And also we have to remember that 1940s there was a crisis of housing as well. And so these inner city suburbs, I mean, thank goodness the immigrants came and repaired them. They repaired them. They looked after them. They cleaned them. They put in, and we've got to remember it was fairly rudimentary. Mm-hmm. Many of them did not have running water. Mm-hmm. The toilets were often, half a kilometre down the back yard.
Maybe not half a kilometre, but a fair way, let's say.
A fair way, 200 metres or 100 or whatever. A fair way. A swimming pool distance, let's say. Mm-hmm. And the electricity was very, very in bad shape. So the skills, if you like, the handy person skills that these immigrants brought with them, and the kind of sense of collectivity and working together on repairing these houses, brought them up to a kind of a better standard of housing. So a lot of immigrants would say, We whitened them. We brought the light in, because they obviously took out the tiny windows and put in large windows. We brought the sunshine in. We put terrazzo down, or tiles, or, new floors and things like that. And we painted those walls inside, so they brightened them up.
And when you see one of these houses, and I know exactly the type of house that you're talking about, they're not revered, are they? They're sort of seen as a kind of an imperfect sort of dwelling. They're not seen as historically correct. They've been modified, they've been changed. They're things that you could quite easily, under the current heritage laws, return back to its Victorian era decoration and form. Is that fair to say?
Oh, totally. I think even more excessive than that. The heritage discourse has been increasing and quite dominant. And I don't have anything against the heritage discourse. I think that we need a heritage discourse, but a slightly nuanced one and a slightly more interesting one, I would say. But the heritage discourse has certainly, these suburbs obviously also became desirable suburbs.
Sure.
Because of their kind of more street culture that was also introduced by the post-war immigrants, and we might get to that at some other stage. But so the idea of cafes and promenading in the street and all of that, so that these suburbs escalated in terms of real estate value, and thereby people from those middle ring suburbs came back into those suburbs, into the inner city suburbs, and hundreds, if not thousands, of these immigrant adaptations of the workers' cottages are stripped back to their well, I wouldn't say stripped back, because they've reapplied a kind of a heritage aesthetic, not always precise or accurate, in fact, mostly not historically, but reapplied. And so we all know the white painted cottage with a row of white roses with a white picket fence. That's the return to a past.
So at the same time, a lot of those migrant families moved to places like Northcote, Thornbury, Preston and other areas, and actually developed a suburban detached house and actually did lots of really interesting things with that as well, particularly in terms of the way they used the land and the planning that they used within the dwellings. They tended to have terraces that overlooked the front yard. They had a sort of quite a different way of living within that sort of model. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think that even in the repairs and renovations of these existing dwellings, there was already a kind of a remodeling, if you like, especially of the relationship between the interior of the house and the exterior, and the relationship between private and public. And so this was a remodeling, because these people's dwelling ways of living were much more about sociality and the street and the neighbourhood, and they wanted that link, so that when they were able to, and not all of them were able to, but those that were able to build a new house and, yes, moved somewhere that was still affordable but not in the inner city, when they were able to build a new house, they didn't invent a new model. They just took the brick veneer detached housing model. But what they did is reconfigured this typology. And so if you imagine a plan of a normal brick veneer, you know, three-bedroom house, what they did was both extend that plan outwards into these almost outdoor rooms, these terraces. And it wasn't just one. It would be one at the front, one on the side, one at the back. These sort of outdoor spaces. So the house was kind of stretched outwards. And then also in the interior, the recalibration of the space in the interior is that they wanted people to come over and have gatherings and so forth. So the interior, sometimes in some of the best examples, what you see is these double doors of a series of rooms opening up to make almost like a little mini reception area.
I know it well.
Yeah, so therefore they were able to bring a kind of a cultural agenda and articulate that spatially and architecturally by remodeling the brick veneer house.
I think that's absolutely fascinating. And so essentially it's an adaptation of a specific type of dwelling that's very common here in Australia. I wonder if you wouldn't mind. Now, I understand the stereotypes that exist around this form of housing. It's not valued in the same way as something that we might call Anglo-Celtic Australian housing is. I think that's reasonably fair to say. I've had discussions with people about this. There's a sort of denigration of this sort of architecture. It's seen as second class. It's seen as a poor adaptation. There's often a view that this work, this sort of architecture, is a memory of what actually exists in their own home country. But you've argued that that's not the case, that it's actually an expression of optimism and about a certain faith or a desire to put down roots here in Australia, and their own version of what housing and living in Australia actually means. Is that how you see it?
Yes, largely, yes. There is the stereotypical one, and the image that actually constructs that stereotype, which is the bottle balustrades, the terrazzo, the stairs, the concrete gardens, and all of that. And I suppose, you know, that, I mean, most non-architect design housing is probably not valued in Australia, except there is a hierarchy of what heritage values.
Sure.
And so that hierarchy would include, obviously, the Victorian houses or the workers' cottages, but also the Californian bungalows and the Queen Anne and so forth, which were probably at their time equally non-architect designed, I must say, and especially the workers' cottages. But I think it's very important to keep those layers, if you like, within our built environment. But what is really, so in a way, my study focuses on a particular piece of migration history, and there are other pieces that are equivalent to this, but I haven't looked into those in great detail. So mine focuses on the Southern Europeans that came in the post-war period up into the sort of from the 50s to the 70s. And I think that first wave and the first wave of cultural confrontation at the level of the built environment, they hated these dark little places. They thought they were so undignified and so low to the ground and full of plumbing problems and so forth. They hated them. So they really had a desire for a much more dignified house. And a little bit of monumentality enters in that. But additionally, and I think very important, that many of these people had building skills, had artisan skills. So they weren't just completely ad hoc. They did have building backgrounds. They did have crafting backgrounds. They had aesthetic backgrounds, if you like. So they were able to perceive spatially what they wanted and how then to not only build that pragmatically, but also to articulate it architecturally. So it's a slight difference there. So they were kind of able to realize their desire for a different kind of house because there was both individual skills, but also collectively, there was a lot of building skill, lot of crafting skill.
And they relied on that network to essentially create a form of housing or a form, an aesthetic consideration. My understanding in talking to you is that they relied very heavily on their own networks. They were kind of, you know, someone could do terrazzo, someone could do metal work, someone could do brickwork, and that kind of community was built up around this style of architecture that I've come to appreciate much, much more. There's certainly aesthetic considerations. You know, the type of brickwork is often identifiable, the type of terrazzo that's identifiable. Not a lot of timber is typical of this sort of architecture, is how I see it. And also a really strong emphasis on garden, a productive garden typically, and facing onto the street. So almost a sense that you looked out upon the street as part of your own living area is what I recall when I think of these houses.
Yes, certainly. And the timber is, there was a lot of joinery expertise as well. So there's a lot of joinery also built by that network of immigrant skill and immigrant trade skills. But yes, there was a much more leaning towards durable materials.
Sure.
Because there was a sense of non-durability in their whole migration trajectory, that mobility. They wanted to really set and stage a kind of a more enduring belonging, if you like. And so there was, emphasis on bricks, but of course their finances often didn't allow for all types of bricks, so they went for the cheaper wire-cut orange bricks rather than the cream pressed bricks. And so that's one identifiable,
it's a clear identifier, isn't it?
Clearly an identifiable feature of these houses. And then the terraces, there's a cultural, or what I call a spatio cultural agenda there. They wanted interaction with the people in the street, with the neighbours, so that your place of sitting to have your coffee is at the front of the house, not at the back. So therefore, there had to be a place for that. So these large, spacious terraces were for that cultural kind of practice. And wave into your neighbours and just saying hello. You don't have to have a very long conversation. You don't have to go to their place and sit inside in the living room to have a coffee. You just have a little conversation here on a daily basis. And, you know, that exists also in the public arena, in the streets. That idea of promenading in a street and stopping and having a little hello, but also saying hello to people that you don't necessarily have as friends, but that they are part of your neighbourhood, community. In your community, and that acknowledgement that you are part of the neighbourhood and the community was what many of the Southern Europeans brought, amongst many other ethnic groups.
Sure. So when I recall being taught architecture at architecture school, you know, by very good historians, it was a very much a lineage, that it was a sort of a progression. You know, you could almost go from, you know, ancient Greek right through to modernism as this kind of an unfolding story, the lineage that sort of connected the dots from one place to the other. And when I talk to you, perhaps I should have been aware of it at the time, it's much more complex than that, isn't it? It's much more layered. There are just so many facets to architecture that we all sort of belong to. But in the way in which we're taught about architecture, and particularly architecture of the 70s and 80s and 90s, there was this very strong, you know, there's a sense of, you know, with the work of, say, Glenn Murcutt, about the Australian outback being really important, about the sitting lightly on the land, modernism, a very aesthetically stripped back, pure modernism, that it's almost like decoration. And we're talking later than the Victorian era, obviously, here, but we're talking about a kind of version of Australia that is this kind of stripped back, modernist aesthetic, touching the ground lightly. Often architecture of that we're talking about is seen as very heavy, very opulent, a bit distasteful. It sort of runs against the grain, from what I can tell, of what is aesthetically correct, I suppose. We're revisiting that now with the films like about Franco Cozzo and other things, that we're perhaps more sophisticated than we once were. But aesthetically, there was a real collision between, you know, the sort of modernist aesthetic on one hand and the more opulent, you know, more decorative, I suppose, on the other hand. Is that a fair comment?
Yes, but I'd like to just sort of take it apart a little bit. In that, I think, first of all, what was confronting is cultural diversity, and the kind of manifestation of cultural diversity in the built environment. All these people might have lived in very modernist houses, but they would still have been very noticeable, mm-hmm. as different. And I would even argue the houses that I've been interested in, and the reason I've been interested in, is because in a way that there's a period of that first generation of immigrants that built much more modernist houses. And in fact, that's what they did to the Victorian terraces.
They modernised them.
Cleaned them up. These houses between the 50s and the mid-70s are very clean geometries. They are, you know, these sort of striking kind of monumentality in terms of their strict linearity. And the windows and the fenestration are very kind of ordered. There's a strong modernist order in them. And so in that sense, they are... And I think if you look at then the émigré architects that came out in that period, they were also more modernist than the modernism that was in Australia.
So we're talking about Frederick Romberg, we're talking about Harry Seidler, we're talking about...
But even the lesser known ones of Fuchs and Alex Jelinek, and there's just many of them, mm-hmm. many of them, that brought in a much more kind of socially oriented modernism that just addressed the collective as much as the individual, but then I would argue that the thing that you raised before, the garden, the garden is critical to this reconstructing a home in a foreign place for the immigrants. So the garden is a way of caring for the land as much as it is a way of caring for the family or one another, you know. And the garden becomes, for in many of these immigrants' housing, becomes an edible garden at the back. So there's fruit trees, there's vegetable gardens, remembering that the seeds for many of these things were illegally transported into Australia, but today make up our cuisine, let's say, and all our markets, food markets. And so the garden, and you know, but in addition to that, pigeons, rabbits, you know, livestock even, winemaking goes on in the backyard. You know, the tomato sauce in the Macedonian tradition, there's aivar, where you have to roast. It's this incredibly long process, roast the peppers, then grind them, then roast them again, then, you know, until it reduces to this amazing sort of relish. Then there's all the outdoor summer kitchens that are part of this. Now, they're, I think, a particularly sort of immigrant innovation within Australia, where they didn't want the smells of the fish and so forth to be inside the house, and also because there was collective cooking and collective making preserves and salamis and all the rest of it. So there is a kind of a diversity of what I would call cultural spaces that are about caring for the land and the community. The thing of touching the earth lightly, once you build a house, I think it's very difficult to claim that you touch the earth lightly. Of course, when you're in the bush, if you raise the house so that the creatures can keep going underneath, that's one way of doing it. And yes, the monumentality of these houses and the solidness of them does contrast that.
But there's a sort of it's offset by an understanding of the land or the use of the land that becomes very interesting, isn't it? It's a sort of it is cultivating the footprint of the property to be as productive as possible, seems to me.
Yes, and and you know, there's a thing that I don't know whether to get to this now or maybe we're going to bring it up in a minute, but I think it's very important that these not only vernacular traditions that are imported, because I don't think that's actually what happens. I think what happens is that if the immigrants have very different ways of living, that will be imported with them. Now, out of those immigrants, some of them will have these skills in order to articulate that and manifest it in the built environment. And I think that is an adaptation between, I would call it diasporic architecture. It's not like the homeland architecture. Many of these immigrants lived in high-rise socialist apartments, you know, and others lived in the villages. They're not bringing that over here. In fact, they wanted to get away from that. so what they're bringing is their sensibility of, for example, living both inside and outside, having a permeability between the interior and the exterior, having kitchens outside, you know, all of this sort of thing. They're bringing their sensibilities and trying to find a material and spatial articulation of that in Australia.
It's so exciting. And I mean, it seems very commonplace what a lot of these innovations were at the time. Like, we do have outdoor kitchens, we do have a much more connected sensibility between inside and outside, and the idea of a productive garden. I mean, I have a huge interest in sustainability. It seems like at a very grassroots level, this kind of architecture, this kind of way of living is very connected with place, community, productive gardens, spatially aware spaces, you know, that so that there's this connection between spaces. It's not being holed up in a little room. It's about connection between places and terraces and so on and so forth. So it kind of feels to me like the idea of living, you know, wisely, using your resources wisely, is very much part of this kind of architecture. Is that I suspect it's born out of necessity, but it's also this, it seems to me that there is a very strong sense of but wanting to belong to a place, like not really needing to go beyond it to actually be quite comfortable and happy with what you've got. Is that the sense that you get?
Yes, I think a little bit more agency than that, in that they wanted to remake situations into a world where they do belong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of this invites the architectural community to actually get inspiration from the what I call spatio-cultural diversity of our built environment, because there's a huge number of traditions that are kind of being adapted and remolded, if you like, within Australia, that have come into Australia, and these and they refer perhaps to other kind of inspirations from anywhere, all those parts of the world where immigrants have come from. But these are spatial traditions, and there's an opening, an invitation for us as the architectural community to draw from this in order to understand who we are as Australians, for a start, but also to draw from it in terms of a broader and broader and richer palette of what we can do in the built environment. And being resourceful is certainly one of them. Many of these houses would have a whole section where there's building material that's, who knows what will happen to it, but it's there, and there's, you know, tools lying around the place. And so there was always a sense of remaking your environment where something did not quite sit right. You kind of mended it and repaired it and remade it. And I think there was a care. There was what, you know, I know that in scholarship these days there's a lot of discussion around maintenance and care, and a garden is that. A garden requires care. But so what? One of the things that these houses and the households, the people living in them, bring to the foreground is that for this to stay a home, it requires maintenance and care. And I'm not saying it was always all positive. Mm, there were demands, sure. And the people looked after the house sometimes more than they looked after themselves, you know, which was a bit of a problem.
Sure.
And there was lots of negativity around that. But nonetheless, there is something there about caring for the home, and the home is more than just your house. It's also your neighbourhood.
Mm.
So that level of interactivity that was really engendered. There's lots of cactus, fig trees and all sorts of things along the railway tracks in Melbourne. So there was a sense of, you know, there was a larger, broader environment. And, of course, all the market gardens, mm. like, mm. you know, the series in East Brunswick, the one that used to be Joe's vegetable garden that series have now inherited from an immigrant. So there's a kind of an ecological, and even the front gardens, which I call the most, the ones that no one wants to talk about because they're not vegetables and they're not, you know, fruit trees and things like that, because they are the public face.
So often, there is again another stereotype, the white stones, pebbles. Concrete pebbles, fairly manicured plants, a sort of an arid landscape in some cases. I mean, obviously there's variety to it, but it wasn't the sort of lush garden that we're sort of used to, the sort of Victorian garden that we see elsewhere. But again, it has its own beauty, doesn't it? It's really, really special.
And that aesthetic, I think, was very confronting, and it's the public face of these houses. I mean, all architecture has a public face, but the garden then gives you a kind of a framing onto that public face. And interestingly, the garden, when these houses have now been sold, the people, that first generation of immigrants, many have passed away, many are elderly. The first thing that gets changed is the garden. But I have to say, that is a happy coincidence, because the houses are not demolished. Now, I'll talk about demolition in a minute, but the front garden gets altered. But these immigrant front gardens, I mean, many of these people came from places that were not, in terms of water resources and so forth, were not so different to Australia.
Sure.
And so they're actually ecological. In many ways, the cactus and the pebbles really maintain the water moisture underneath, and the rosemary and the, you know, all these sort of plants, they survive many, many kind of droughts and terrible summers and so forth. And they've introduced the most phenomenal aesthetic, because the white pebbles set this stage of almost like a white canvas on which these very placed, if you like, cactus or rocks, almost like a Zen garden, were placed in that canvas of white pebbles. Phenomenal, rich aesthetic.
I can't help smiling because my parents are Italian. I have, you know, strong connections with that part of my life, and it's kind of invigorating. I can't imagine, I don't remember talking about, you know, this sort of stuff at university when I was doing architecture. So talking about you just brings a huge smile to my face. And it sort of demonstrates a kind of more culturally diverse sort of architecture that we've got here in Australia. I mean, there are, you know, many facets to it. We're talking about really one aspect of it. I think, to sort of bring this discussion to some form of conclusion, because I'd like to talk a little bit about contemporary architects who are, you know, we're talking in specifically about the vernacular architecture with what your discussion has been, but people who have a migrant background who are maybe second generation architects and their contribution to architecture. It's been really interesting looking at work around Melbourne and seeing how some of these houses are being transformed, how they're being demolished. There's one particular house that is near me where I think that the architect has actually kind of adapted this what we'll call migrant architecture house into something that is quite special. I'll post some images of it. But in terms of sort of what you're seeing in contemporary architecture and locally, has this sort of architecture been adapted and absorbed into the mainstream of architecture? Is it a kind of more less linear sort of architecture, more diverse architecture that we're seeing as a result of your research and just opening up the discussion as to what architecture? I notice arches are very big now in contemporary architecture. I don't know whether that is paying homage to migrant architecture. I don't know. But what's your view on contemporary architecture in relation to this work?
I think there is a little bit more interest. And as I say, even at the grassroots level, when people purchase one of these houses, it is a great delight to me that they're not automatically demolished, and I, you know, I see some of those houses that I've recorded and documented, and they look beautiful. They're cleaned up by the new owners. There is a new native, in quotation marks, garden at the front. but otherwise they are really cared for and loved, and I think that's good. In terms of architects and the architectural community, there certainly is some interest in the kind of the diversity. And of course, we all know the example of the beautiful Punchbowl Mosque mm-hmm. project in Sydney by Angelo Candelapis and the Glenn Murcutt Mosque in Newport in Melbourne. So there's quite interesting stories about the architects and how they engaged with those communities to do that. I do think there could be, it is an invitation for much more engagement at this level of diversity in our built environment. And in fact, given that we are 50% people from somewhere else in Australia, according to the newest census, I think that there is much more capacity and kind of creativity to be explored in this. Having said that, I think that there are a couple of things that I perhaps want to say. And one is that in terms of statistics, these are the houses that are way more readily demolished than any other houses. Some of them are on corners, and so small-time developers love to knock them down and build, you know, in that one house, three units or whatever. And there was one house near me that you know, this is all in the kind of the, for the purpose of high density and so forth. Now, I do think that it's about time that this policy of high density has a bit more nuance. It's a bit black and white in my view. And, you know, everyone's very, the architectural community is very enthusiastic about density, and that's in principle good, but I think there needs to be more nuance architecturally. And there's one place that I documented, which was a house on a corner block. It was had a very large, extensive backyard where there were winemaking facilities, where the people had kept chickens and pigeons. There was this amazing remnants and traces of a productive garden. The house itself was two-story, cubic block with a flat roof, concrete roof. Interiors were made by the person who had lived there, who was able to do all this metal work for the balustrades, for lots of locks and latches and things like that, for the screens on the windows. It was a museum piece that got demolished. And I'm sure the people that are living in the seven three-story units are very, very happy because it's on a gorgeous site. But there is a question for me. There is no garden, no orchard, no vegetables, no open space. These seven units are pretty jam-packed against one another. So we need to ask ourselves a question of at what point in this question of density or garden, how do we make those decisions?
Aren't you asking also another question that I presume that the planning controls over that area? I don't know the house. It sounds beautiful, sounds exceptional. It wouldn't have attracted heritage status because of a preference for Victorian, Edwardian, sort of English, Celtic, Anglo-Celtic architecture. You're making a statement really as much about that as about density, are you not?
Yes, yes, absolutely. No, this house would not have attracted heritage overlay, and neither, and it's not just this house, it's numerous numbers of these houses which are often in better condition than their adjacent or proximate Californian bungalow or something, and that those ones do attract heritage interest and overlays, and these houses
do not. So there is And there is sort of a political, or let's call it a power, or I don't know what quite the right word is, but there is
it's
a statement.
It's called AHD, Authorial Heritage Discourse.
I'm glad you're here telling me that. But there is this kind of, there is an underlying sense that it is of lesser value than something that came from an Anglo-Celtic tradition, more or less.
It's of lesser value at that level of our inheritance. And if heritage is linked to our complex and kind of interwoven histories, then it is a question why a Californian bungalow might have more heritage interest than a post-war immigrant house. I'm not suggesting that all these places get conserved.
Of course.
However, there are pockets which, and also in Australia, we're very quick to wipe the slate clean. Mm. And yet what we love also in Melbourne is that kind of layered built environment where we can see the stratas of change and coexisting. And this is why we also love to have and encourage and envision heritage sites for Indigenous First Nations people amongst, you know, as a continuity, if you like, in our lives, not as something from the past, but as something in the present and into the future. So it's while it may be perceived as backward looking, I think it's about what kind of environment do we want forward looking, because it could become incredibly homogeneous if we're not careful. Or I was going to say something else too, in that you know, one of my other projects that I've been working on is vacancy, and especially in Geelong, where all the industrial large tracts of land, many of the industries have left. And so the question is, there's all this vacant industrial structure and landscapes. And the question is, well, what's going to happen to these sites and buildings? And so our project reconsiders the value of industrial heritage and architecture as a kind of an embodied memory. Because I think, you know, we have to pause and think. As a philosopher once said, Paul Virilio, he wrote about speed and our speedy kind of ways to do things. And increasing speed can be catastrophic. You know, for example, we all know that when we've wrongly pressed the button on an SMS message and an accident or an email and it's accidentally gone off, too quickly realizing a bit late that, oh, perhaps I shouldn't have said that. So far better, I think, to pause, you know, and in the same way, pause before we demolish. Mm. In case we wipe ourselves out of existence, because our history and our embodied memory of that is part of our existence, and Paul Virilio called this the aesthetics of disappearance. So this sort of memory is and inheritance. So when we're thinking about the future, do we just imagine all that has gone? Because if we don't think about it and just do it in a pragmatic way, oh well, we don't want this, we'll get rid, oh, we don't want this, then it will be gone.
It certainly will, and it does paint a picture of a certain kind of bias that's built into the system of how we preserve some things in favour of other things. I as an architect working in the inner suburbs, I've certainly witnessed that, and it's kind of leads to questions as to what really is of value and what should be retained and what shouldn't be. And it's complex, and you are seeing suburbs that are essentially looking very homogenous, very similar, the whole sort of architecture of planning, you know, in inner suburban residential developments, does have a sort of sameness about it. It doesn't have that kind of multi-layered approach and different families living in there and different sort of conditions that it once did have. So I think it's certainly really, really relevant to the way in which our cities work. There is a kind of homogeneity that appearing, even if we kind of talk about inclusivity and, you know, diversity. It's a strange phenomena that I sort of see at an urban level in the inner suburbs. You know, architects are really capable of doing really creative solutions, but often we're constrained, I think, by the rules that govern, you know, heritage overlays and setback rules and, you know, the way in which things have to work in order to meet certain guidelines and certain codes. It becomes very formulaic. We're not getting that kind of diversity, that different approach to living in terms of the individual house or multi-residential dwellings. It's, you know, it becomes almost a tick-a-box sort of approach to architecture, which I find a bit depressing, I've got to be honest with you. And what I see in the work that you're talking about is genuine creativity at a sort of grassroots level, a kind of an incremental change to the way in which people lived and the way people occupied space, and it had become something that's really valuable. Really interesting, I think, to think about what could be if we open our eyes to different possibilities of how you use a suburban block in the inner urban areas of Melbourne, in urban areas of, you know, Sydney or Perth or wherever. So,
I think that there was a big change, actually, because, the whole concept of suburb is homogeneity in a sense, but there was a big change when developers, because we know that the majority, 95% of the housing in Australia is built by developers, so the architects have a very minor role in all that. But it could, you know, whether that mechanism can get changed, I'm not sure, in terms of cost and so forth. But I think there's a misconception amongst the community of how much an architect designed house costs and how much another house costs. But that's something for the architectural community to kind of address. However, there was a change, I think, when these people were building the houses. They were networked, so they were able to make, you know, these small changes and reconfiguration of the house and so forth. I think that these days there's a kind of a global aesthetic of a desirable house. So not only is it homogeneous here, we're probably the same as everywhere else in the world. And so there was the much larger volume builders which brought in a global kind of palette of
kind of standardization of aesthetics.
Well, it's more than standardization. I would call it an image flow, like a desirable image, and because everything is about the little bits of features and so forth. And you know, sometimes there's a strange conflation between, say, some of the Baroque aspects of late 70s and 80s immigrant housing with that. And I think that's very mistaken because, as we saw in the film Palazzo di Cozzo, these Baroque aesthetic was, what's called a neo-Baroque aesthetic. It's not actually Baroque, of course. And people are very happy to sort of joke about it. But I think there is something in there about the aesthetic taste that, and as the historian in that film points out, that, you know, Baroque was very different to the Renaissance, deliberately so, and deconstructed its strict orders. And then when we all saw how that Franco Cozzo furniture that we, both as immigrants and non-immigrants, used to perhaps laugh about, was made, and how sensuous the making of it was, we had a very different perhaps attitude towards it, and a slight opening, you know, we might even say, and then if so, I think that we need to also know more about one another, you know, and because I think what's happening in with the volume housing, there is a lot of diversity under the blanket of suburbia.
Sure.
But it's kind of
concealed.
Presented in this mask of sameness. Mm. And I think that there is even, you know, new forms of racism that almost culturally disavow some of that diversity to be articulated in the built environment in the same way that these courageous post-war immigrants did. And there's something, and I think it's important also to, understand that detail matters. And I think this is one thing that you really pay attention to and care about, that detail matters, you know. And I think we have to see how detail matters to this diversity of communities and individuals in our Australian society. And I have a great kind of unforgettable moment when I was standing there when the interior of my house was being painted by my father, Tome, and his friend, Yonche, both skilled, highly skilled painters. So my father was a building painter, but he, back in the homeland, was using very kind of sophisticated stencils to paint entire walls, 7 layers of them, which he never got to do here after arrival. But I could see that sophistication in this moment when I was listening to them have a conversation about the colour, and there was almost like this sort of very intricate, very refined way of describing, this is not quite right, no, it needs a little bit more of this, and this is not quite right, it needs a bit more of this. You know, so those details, and the same in you know, larger buildings and urban, are very important. And to get to that sensitivity, to listen to the diversity of what people have to bring in terms of the detail, you know, in terms of leaving their shoes out the front door, in terms of having a little Buddha altar or sure. something like that, in terms of having screens so that there's a kind of a layered visibility. I mean, I think that that is a sophistication in architecture and our built environment, and that is, it could only make our built environment better.
The idea that two people spent a whole lot of time contemplating the exact shade of blue to sort of capture the sky, the feeling of the sky. Obviously, that's something that, you know, as an architect, I do spend a bit of time on. I, you know, rather than the sort of whitewashing of spaces, which ends up looking incredibly bland, is something that I think is really important. I'll sort of round this up, if I may, and just ask about, and you know, we talk a lot about sustainability and it's just I guess what I'm hearing is that there is this sense of the care for the environment has a kind of connection to place and people that is a really nice foundation for the sort of work that most of us architects practicing in Melbourne and other places can really learn from, rather than this kind of blanket approach of, you know, ticking boxes and so on and so forth. So there's something in that that I think that we can really learn from in terms of the migrant experience, that the way in which resources are used to the really the best effect possible to have that sort of longevity, to have actually that pride in the place, I think is something that really resonates with me when I hear you talk about the way in which migrant architecture, the contribution of migrants to architecture here in Australia. Is that a fair point?
Yes, yes. I don't know whether you want me to respond. But
no, you no. can maybe respond with a concluding remark and then I'll...
Yeah, I think that one of the things we haven't touched on is the social bond and how space is so critical for our how we perceive our collective and individuality, our collectivity and individuality. And I think that one of our most important resources is people,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so how us as architects and how we mould the built environment, and we saw this obviously during COVID, and it is not in any way to undermine the whole virtual world and realm and capacity, but we also have a real realm and capacity, which is where
we
our
live.
Spatial environment is. So I think that one of the things that all these diversity of peoples bring to us is often a very a big emphasis on the social bond. And, you know, that is a caring, to care for one another is an extension of caring for the environment and your place.
I'm just going to give you a massive thank you for coming on my little podcast. And I hope everyone who listens to this enjoys it as much as I have. I think it's been really rewarding and really learnt a lot, as I do with every conversation I have with you, Mariana. So really, from the bottom of my heart, thank you very much for coming in.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Anthony. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. So we'll say goodbye and hope you keep listening to the podcast and we'll talk soon. Thank you.